Country code, which is Australian. So good morning to you in Australia. Good afternoon to you in California and other parts of the West Coast. And good evening to those of you who are in the evening part of this time zone, timeline. And of course, to those of you in Europe, really, really, really good evening because it's about 3 a.m. So it's, again, it's wonderful to be here. It's wonderful to be here with you all on Valentine's Day. And also in the aftermath of Shivaratri, I know many of you celebrated Shivaratri last night, and I did also, and was really powerfully struck by how much this study has impacted my experience of meditation, because, you know, Shivaratri for me is always a powerful evening, filled with memories of all the many Shivaratri celebrations that I've participated in over the years, and also of my private practice. But what was very special for me last night was that I had been, like many of you, doing the practice of looking at my process of perception as the fivefold act, and actually doing a practice which kind of came to me last night in the middle of it, and which we will practice together tonight, of closing my eyes and just setting in place the bhavana, which is a Sanskrit word that many of you know, but for those of you who don't, it means the creative contemplation or the attitude that you adopt to take you into relationship with a higher awareness. And I was playing with the bhavana. When I open my eyes, I'm going to experience the world flowing out of me. And then when I close my eyes, I'll experience the world flowing back into me. So I was doing this practice, opening my eyes, feeling that the universe was being created from inside me, sustaining that for a little while, and then closing my eyes with the feeling that the universe was dissolving back into me. And maybe because it was Shivaratri, that is, it was a night full of strong grace, I actually began to feel the world dissolving into me. Yes, of course, there was, as there always is, the trace of the image of the room, which was where I was practicing. And, that kind of the samskara of the room that makes memory. And as I was practicing, I suddenly had a memory of one of my very early experiences of awakening, which it was in my second retreat with my teacher, and we were sitting in meditation when suddenly my awareness devoured all the forms in the room. I'm using the word devoured because that's the language that Kshema Raja uses, but my experience at the time was that my awareness swelled up and actually sucked in all the forms in the room and also the forms in the universe. My eyes were closed, but what became apparent to me in that moment was that there was only awareness in the universe. There was nothing else. There is nothing else. And that awareness is me. And my experience in that moment, I have to tell you, was of complete panic. It was like I had suddenly discovered that I was all alone in the universe. And I didn't have the, let's call it the bala, the strength, which is another sutra that we're going to be looking at tonight, to hold that without fear. And last night, as I was doing this, the practice of feeling that when I opened my eyes, I was creating the scene in front of me, and when I'm closing my eyes, I'm dissolving it. As I remembered that experience, I suddenly began to have an intimation of something that's been coming up a lot in the listserv, which is of how there is simultaneously our personal creation, that is, the experience that we have of a world, and then there is the collective creation, that is, the entire thing which Chitti is manifesting through each of these sentient beings, not only us, but also plants and animals and trees. And I found myself trying to hold this recognition of how incredibly vast and complex the display that Chitti is creating through all of us, and my mind just went into complete tilt, and for a few moments I was just in Shivaness. It was like it all withdrew. So Shivaratri and Valentine's Day, in a certain sense, Shivaratri is the apotheosis of Indra and consciousness, and of course Valentine's Day is all about relationship. So let's allow this Valentine's Day to be held sacred to the union of awareness and bliss, to the waltz of Shiva and Shakti, to the amazing process by which consciousness creates apparent duality and then withdraws it in every moment, and the mystery of that, how that happens, and how it is that we can actually experience this as real, not simply as something that we're reading about or feeling for moments in meditation, but as something that is our actual experience. That is kind of what the Pratyabhijna Hridayam is promising us, that as we follow this paradigm, as we follow this practice, through grace, we start to recognize how this universe is in a constant state of being created and dissolved, concealing itself and revealing itself as what it is. So we will begin with the mantras or continue with the mantras, and then as we come out of our chanting, we'll go into meditation, and then we'll start our conversation. So let's, before Deb puts on the mantras, let's just take a moment and dedicate our practice, asking that through the power of our practice, all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May we know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. May all beings be free of grasping, hatred, and dullness. May we know the equality of all that lives. And so it is. So if you have your chant sheets, Deb will put on our mantras sung by Scott, and we will chant together.
Shivaya Satatam Panchakritya Vidhayine Chidananda Gana Swatma Paramartha Vasne. Namah Shivaya Satatam Panchakritya Vidhayine Chidananda Gana Swatma Paramartha Vabhasane. Namah Shivaya Satatam Panchakritya Vidhayine Chidananda Gana Swatma Paramartha Vabhasane. Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shiva Dhatri Swaha Swadha Namostute. Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shiva Datri Swaha Swadha Namostute Om Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shiva Datri Swaha Swadha Namostute Om Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shiva Datri Swaha Swadha Namostute
Finding the posture, feeling the connection of your sits bones with the seat and the connection of your seat with the earth. Allow the breath to bring your attention into the heart. This is Valentine's Day, and we're going to begin with the feeling that as the breath flows into the heart, it begins to touch our connection with the entwined forms of Shiva and Shakti, of awareness and bliss, inside the heart center. And for those of you who are gifted at visualization or who would like to try it, I'm going to suggest that you imagine Shiva and Shakti reclining together on a couch, like one of those old Roman couches that they used for banquets. They're embracing each other. And inside your heart, begin to feel that Shakti is making offerings to Shiva of delicious morsels of food, offering them into his mouth. And Shiva is making offerings of delicious morsels of food to Shakti. Imagine the two of them playing in your heart, feeding each other, laughing, embracing each other, in this state of playful union. Now begin to feel that the breath flowing in through the heart, as though there were an opening or a softening in the chest wall, and the breath can flow in, the prana can flow in directly into the heart center. Feel that you are offering homage, praise. Let's go so far as to say worship. Of Shiva and Shakti seated in your heart through the offering of the mantra Om Namah Shivaya. Om Namah Shivaya, although it is a mantra dedicated to Shiva, also contains in its heart the fullness of Shakti. The power within the mantra is the power of Shakti. Allow your inhalation to draw your attention into the heart with the thought, Om Namah Shivaya. Imagine the mantra being offered into the laps of these two deities seated in the heart. And imagine that with the exhalation, the fullness of their affection for each other and the fullness of their presence in your heart simply spreads through your heart, just the way honey spreads. the honey of the communion of Shiva and Shakti spreading through your own heart. As you offer Om Namah Shivaya into their embrace, and you can open your eyes or not. And let's see if we can keep some part of our awareness in the heart and inside the recognition of this Valentine's Day union of the two who are never separate and who are the union of bliss and awareness within the heart. So we're approaching now the moment of cosmic turnaround, where the arc of the narrative about the soul's journey moves from involution, that is to say, flowing into greater and greater contraction, to evolution, that is, flowing more and more strongly towards self-recognition. And, of course, Sutras 10 and 11 are the exact middle of the book. Sutras 9 and 12, that is to say the sutra about the mala-covered samsara that we talked about in so much detail 2 weeks ago, and Sutra 12, which says that unless we are recognizing that our process of perception is the same as Shiva Shakti's fivefold act, as long as we're not recognizing the congruence between our experience and God's experience, then we are deluded, this is what Sutra 12 says, by our own powers, by our own shaktis, by our senses, by our minds, which, remember, are aspects of shakti, that is, the powers that send our senses seeking outward, the powers that constantly cycle psychically through the various phases of the psychic instrument, thinking, seeking out stimulation, making judgments and discernments, and constantly making the decision, this is me, this is not me, this is me, this is not me. All of those processes are constantly going on under our radar, under our awareness, and sending our attention into the realms of duality, making us believe that not only are we separate from the wholeness, but we're separate from everyone and everything else. So this is the contracted experience. It's the nadir of the story. And in Sutras 10 and 11, Kshema points out that even in this contracted state, all is not lost. We're still spirit having a human experience. We're still chitti experiencing herself, even though she's experiencing herself as a half-crazed human mind. Still, she is still doing in this contracted state what she is doing in her transcendent state. She's creating, maintaining, dissolving, concealing her true nature, and revealing herself. So Kshema Raja will say again and again and again in different language that the process of self-recognition actually comes from the practice and eventually the true experience that you and I are always performing the same five functions as Shiva Shakti does every time we have a thought or perception. And again, in Sutra 11, we are given what I think for many of you is proving to be a very profound insight about our act of attention. So sort of recognizing how an object manifests for us in its fullness when we focus on it, when we keep our attention focused there, it persists in our experience. It's sort of, if you remember that phrase, what you resist persists, this holds true whether what we're experiencing is positive or negative. If we don't like something, if we're thinking about how much we don't like it, we tend to keep that object alive in our consciousness by not liking it. Kind of like the story about the meditator whose guru told him, whatever you do, don't think of a monkey, and who then found himself unable to free his mind of monkeys. Of course, what he could have done in that situation is what I know you guys are doing when you find yourself caught in a thought or a negativity, or even a particularly sticky positive thought, is you turn back to awareness of yourself as a subject, as the subject, as the experiencer, as the perceiver, and do start to notice that when you do, the monkey fades away. As we practice with Sutra 11, with recognizing what really happens when we become aware of being the perceiving subject, and when we become aware of how actually skillfully, how very skillfully, the more we become aware of awareness, how very skillfully we are able to allow awareness to dissolve the samskaras that come up in the heat of charged experiences. And again, as we know, we've been discussing this, there are different ways of doing this. But they are all based on this same recognition, which is that attention is the most powerful of all our faculties for creating and sustaining the experience of anything, and also for dissolving it. And also to recognize that once we have begun to have a felt sense of our own awareness, then we become able to experience the freedom of our own mind. And this is tremendously important, because without recognizing awareness as the underpinning of all of our thoughts, emotions, images, memories, etc., etc., we are never going to be able to experience actual ownership or true freedom in our mind, because we'll always be tossed around by the way the Shakti endlessly comes up with new thoughts, which is one of the things that it means to say that we're deluded by our own Shaktis, by our own powers. one of the ways, of course, that Shakti deludes us or fools us about our nature is by constantly giving us the experience of thoughts, by constantly throwing up thoughts like a fountain from inside. Chapter 12, or Sutra 12, which is actually, I'm going to say this, and then I frustratingly will tell you that we're not going to work with Sutra 12 tonight. But if you have a chance to read it and study it, I think you'll find that it very much augments the teaching of Sutra 9, because it speaks about the way in which thoughts and words trap us, which is one of the very fundamental ideas of Shaivism, of Tantra. In Sutra 12, we are really at the bottom of the arc. You know, it's as one of the commentators on this sutra says, it's like we're panhandling in the Tenderloin, or maybe in the South Bronx. We're homeless, we're miserable, we're suffering, we don't know who we are. It's the worst. And then in Sutra 13, Kshemaraja officially introduces the method for the journey home. And in fact, the rest of the book is really the unpacking of Sutra 13. As you'll notice, and as we'll see in detail this week and next week, once the journey home starts, it's actually very fast. Somebody compares it to a snowball rolling down a hill. It picks up momentum, gathers speed. And if you think of it in terms of the way that Indian philosophy describes human life, you can look at it like this. Every one of us has lived dozens, perhaps hundreds, perhaps thousands of lifetimes revolving in the wheel of samsara, constantly believing that the world is outside us, and therefore feeling helpless and disempowered and all the things that a samsaran does. And that goes on for a really long time. But then once we have received the diksha, the initiation, the gracious glance of Chitti Shakti, who awakens us to the possibility of turning inside, then the journey actually condenses itself, and the rest of the process of awakening takes a relatively short time, certainly compared to the early part of the process. And even if you're one of those people who is not going to experience full awakening in this lifetime, one of the things that the Pratibhigna Hridayam and the teachers of my lineage promise is that it is inevitable. Once you've started this recognition process, this process of turning inside, then the goal is assured. So Sutra 13 says, Tat parijnane chittam eva antarmukhi bhavena chetana padararo hat chittihi. And what you might see, what the sutra means is, by full realization of your authorship of the fivefold act, the chitta, by turning within, ascends to its expanded state and is revealed as nothing but awareness, that is, chetana. And I'm going to amend this a little bit. Full realization of the fivefold act may not be something that you and I are going to experience full time, but what we can experience is moments of recognizing the fivefold act in ourselves, moments of just getting an intimation of how consciousness is creating, sustaining, and dissolving through each one of us. And in my experience, it's enough to get that. It's enough to know that for chitta to start to turn within. In other words, as soon as we receive this teaching and imbibe it and begin to practice it, we begin experiencing what it means for chitta to turn within. and for chitta to dissolve back into chaitana. And what you see in the Sanskrit here is that the sutra is actually pointing to the reverse process that's described in Sutra 5. And one way we know this is because the same Sanskrit words for the different levels of consciousness recur in the sutra that we originally met in Sutra 5. Chitti, of course, the ultimate awareness. Chaitana, which, if you remember, is pure consciousness without an object. That is, consciousness uncrowded with thoughts. And chitta, which is the ordinary consciousness completely filled with thoughts and the residue of our perceptions. Remembering that in the process of involution, chitti, with her unlimited power and freedom, her pure bliss and awareness, contracts to become a limited individual consciousness, which is experienced as awareness without the power to act, which is the difference between contracted consciousness and expanded consciousness, and then contracts further to become the chitta, your own mind, which is actually never inactive, is always the repository of an insane amount of objects. And the sutra points out that as we start to recognize that our own attention and perspective are replicating Shiva Shakti's cosmic act, there is a natural ascension from thought-clogged mental logging chitta to thought-free awareness chaitana. Again, what this sutra and pretty much the whole of the Pratibhigna Hridayam is pointing out, and it's a really key idea in Tantra that we have spoken of several times, is that bondage and liberation in Tantra has nothing to do with whether you're in your body or not, whether you're focused in your body or not. It's entirely about how you experience your own mind, your personal consciousness, with its powers of intellect, attention, and identity creation. So, and in the process of evolution, as attention turns within to actually start to examine itself, which is basically what we're doing when we do this practice of looking for the fivefold act in our perception, it opens the door to realization. One of my teachers, Guru Mai, used to say that meditation is about teaching the mind its own freedom. And in my experience, that is really true. The reason we meditate, and above all, the reason that we investigate our own perceptual process, is so that we can start to realize that our own mind stuff actually possesses enormous freedom. And that's when we can begin to play with our own mind. So these chapters, at this point in the ascent, begin to describe the core process of self-realization in Shaivism, and which is literally the ability to draw back from constant focus on the external and begin to attend to its own interior. Interiority is the fundamental stance or bhavana of chitti shakti, of Shiva shakti. Interiority, the recognition that everything is happening inside you. So what is implied here, however, in this sutra, and he discusses it at various points in the commentary, is that in order to successfully turn inside in the way that Kshema means it, we actually need two things. We need the teachings. Pratibhigna Hridayam is actually it is one of the core teachings we need in order to perform this act of allowing consciousness to turn inside. And secondly, we need grace. The teachings and the experience of receiving grace are not necessarily two different things, by the way. As you know, this text itself gives enormous grace. But the way I have come to see the way grace works in our inner world is that it's grace, the fifth process, the revelation process, that brings our spiritual capacities online. It's not there, of course. Everything we need is there, but they're offline. So they're disconnected. And we actually need Shakti to connect it up, to bring us online. That's, once that's happened, then we can make the choice to turn inside. As I was thinking about this issue, I remembered one of my very early experiences of self-inquiry. Long before I ever knew what self-inquiry was, I was 21. It was summer. I had my first job, and I was spending the weekend by myself in the country, in the midst of a new high-pressure life. And as I was sitting in the sun, this question came up, just arose in my mind, aside from my opinions and my taste in movies, who am I really? What is mine? What's special about me? What makes me me? And when that question came up, I had absolutely no way to answer it. I didn't know where I could go to find out who I really am. And that's not a question that everybody is interested in. But it wasn't until 7 years later when I actually had an awakening and started to receive teachings, to discover these teachings, that I began to realize that this is a question that people have been asking forever, and that there are actually methods for discovering the truth about who I am, which, as of course we all discover, really has nothing to do with the movies we like or our opinions about things. And as you know, there are a number of ways of turning attention inside, and we're going to be working with several of them this evening. One is actually to focus your attention on the inner body, on the heart center. As Liz shared in her beautiful post today, wrote about turning into the heart and asking herself a question and hearing the answer coming out of her heart. So this is one of the great ways for turning attention within, or you can turn your attention into the hara or into the center of the head. But in other words, our initial understanding about what it means to turn attention inside is to turn into the body instead of focusing outside the body. But Kshema's definition of what it means to turn inside goes beyond that. What he means by inward-facing consciousness is the state of attention where we face into awareness itself. In other words, what he means by inward-facing consciousness is the backward step, as Adyashanti calls it, where attention turns back onto itself. So that instead of identifying with thoughts and emotions, instead of identifying with the body and the energy, we start to identify with awareness itself, which is really the inside of the inside. We could say that your awareness is the holy of holies. It's the inside of the inside. It's the heart itself. So the heart is the heart center, absolutely. The heart is also pure awareness. So inward-facing consciousness doesn't necessarily mean that your eyes are closed or that you're focusing down into the body. In fact, there's a very powerful mudra that's described in the tantras, which is called Bhairavi Mudra or Shambhavi Mudra. And it's a mudra that is said to be the natural state of attention of enlightened beings. Your eyes are open. You're looking out at the world. You may even be interacting at people, but your gaze is fixed inside. Your gaze is fixed on awareness. And in the yoga of the recognition sutras, this open-eyed, inward-facing awareness is what Kshema is talking about as inward-facing consciousness. The formula here is that if you identify with the body, with several people have spoken about this on the listserv, and it's a very key point. It really is all about identification. If you identify with the body, with the thoughts, you're identifying with contraction. When you remember to identify with awareness, you are actually opening the door that allows awareness to expand and reveal what it really is. And again, we work with various pointing out instructions for looking into awareness, for discovering awareness, for staying present to awareness, which again we've mentioned before. You might ask yourself, what is it that knows I'm thinking? And then focus not on the thoughts that come up in answer to the question, but on the felt space that arises in the few seconds after the question is asked. You know, that phrase, pointing out instructions, is actually really good, because what this practice, what is it that knows I'm thinking, does is it points to the awareness that is present to thought, giving you the opportunity to recognize it. And again, as you know, when you ask this question, what knows I'm thinking, what normally arises in the immediate aftermath of the question is a kind of a blank mind. In other words, the mind stops. And ordinarily, our attention moves past the blankness to something that, to a thought or an image or something that we can hang on to. But the purpose of this practice is just to bring your attention to that felt blank space. And as you do that, there is often a shift. And what I often call the underpinning of the mind, which is awareness, that is the background, the screen, comes into the foreground. And the discernment here is to let yourself rest for a moment in that experience, which is chaitanya, pure consciousness, and let yourself get more and more used to it, to finding, noticing, recognizing, resting in awareness. First for, 3 seconds, then for 30 seconds, then for a minute, and just gradually increasing the time that you can rest in awareness. And again, there are many different methods for becoming present to awareness, and I always believe in trying out different ones, because doing self-inquiry gets routinized, it gets old if you do it the same way all the time, and it just doesn't have the shakti, the sharpness, since the human mind demands novelty in order to pay attention. We need to vary the way we're training ourselves to become aware of awareness. Asking, am I aware, is one I like. For lovers of goddess, imagining yourself being held by goddess in her formlessness is actually a way of tuning into awareness. And one of the things I like about experiencing awareness as the embrace of the goddess is that it often brings with it a feeling of tenderness, because it can feel very personal. So that kind of kindles the love aspect of awareness. And then, once you've learned how to do it, you can dip back into it again and again whenever you remember. My guru was once asked, can you describe the state that you live in? Meaning, can you describe your enlightened state? And he said, yes, my state is such that I go beyond the mind, beyond the intellect, and I swim in the ocean of bliss. And then he said, sometimes I come out of it, but I know how to get back into it. And he then went on to explain that how he gets back into it, which essentially is to become aware of awareness and of that vast expanded state, which was his experience of awareness. What actually starts to happen, and I know it's been happening to many of you because you've shared it with me, that at a certain point, as we cultivate this practice of facing into awareness, over and over again through the course of the day, whenever we remember, there comes a point where consciousness actually wants to melt back into its source. In other words, where there's a natural pull inward, a natural pull of attention to focus in on itself. And that's when the snowball of awakening really starts rolling down the hill. And sometimes, as someone shared in the listserv, we're held back from resting in awareness because we're afraid it'll make us disassociated. But the truth is that being aware of awareness is not disassociative. What makes us disassociated is trauma, the traumas that we have stuffed and which have, as children, taught us to leave the body in order to avoid experiencing pain. But the paradox is that the more you can be aware of awareness, the more your awareness can begin to sponsor trauma and dissolve trauma. So every time we remember to turn into an emotion every time we remember to examine a feeling of discomfort, to notice the feeling, sometimes just by saying to ourselves, this hurts, or this feels really bad. In other words, acknowledging the feeling, and then stay present, not so much with your, quote, story, unquote, about it, but with the energetic quality of the feeling. And then taking the backward step and letting yourself hold that feeling in awareness. Every time you do that, you're freeing another layer of stuck energy, including traumatic energy in your consciousness. This particular practice of holding thoughts and emotions and charged or stuck energies in awareness and letting them dissolve is one of the skillful means for transforming consciousness from its contracted state to an expanded state. It is an upaya. And I'd like to take a few minutes and speak about the upayas as they're described in Tantra, especially in the non-dual Tantra that we're working with, because the upayas, the methods of practice that Tantra describes, actually encompass everything that we, quote, do in order to cultivate awakened states. And I've found, as many of you have found, that understanding the upayas, which are really categories of practice, the word upaya is usually translated as skillful means, and skillful is important. What makes a method skillful is that it's been tested. It works, and we know it works because many, many practitioners for many, many centuries have found that it works. And the upayas are directly related to the three malas, to the veils, because this is a self-organizing system, our universe, which means that every contraction has its designated antidote. In other words, there is no poison that doesn't have an antidote, doesn't have a medicine. So as chitti manifests contraction through the three malas, anava mala, maya mala, and karma mala, she also manifests the means for expanding beyond contraction. And each one of the upayas is an antidote to a particular contraction. So I want to start where most of us start, which is with anava mala, and I'll explain the malas as we go along. And I just want to say two general things. First of all, anava mala and anava upaya are different. That, you know, that the same word anava, which means individual or atomized, anava, the word anava refers both to the initial contraction of the wholeness into an individual consciousness, and that's anava mala. And anava upaya is the set of practices you do when you're totally identified with yourself as an individual, when you're totally in a state of duality. I'm in here, you're out there, we're completely different. The goal of the upayas is a state that in Sanskrit is called samavesha, and samavesha literally means becoming the same as the divine. It refers to this natural experience of consciousness merging back into its source, which is experienced through each one of these methods. And so the goal of them, every one of them, is to melt your contractions, to experience your mind as God's mind, your heart as God's heart, and your being as God's being. So anava mala is the practice we do to antidote karma. I'm sorry, anava upaya is the practice we do to antidote karma mala, meaning karma mala is, in my experience, it's the kind of totality of our contraction. Not only do we feel separate from the source, not only do we feel like a particular individual in a world of other very particular individuals, we also fully believe that we are the one who is responsible for our lives. It's what we experience when you're identifying fully with being Michelle or Linda or John or Sally. When you look in the mirror and call that reflection me, that's karma mala. And of course, now many of you are quite sophisticated about what the self, what we think the self is, and what the self actually is. And you may know that it actually could fairly be said that there is no such person as Sally or Linda, because what I call Sally is actually a collection of many different attitudes and selves, all of which seem to be living in the same body and the same mind, but which actually can be very different depending on the day and the mood and the hour. But the truth is that when we are under the influence of the three malas, our experience is, I am this person, I am this body. And, you know, I have good relationships with X and Y, terrible relationships with Z and F. And when I make a mistake, I'm responsible for it unless I can find somebody else to blame. And when I think about karma mala, I always remember a wonderful thing that Bob Thurman, the Buddhist scholar, once said. He said, the way you can identify the ego in yourself is to notice how you react when somebody blames you for something you didn't do. You know, that automatic protest that comes out, I didn't do it, I'm innocent, is one of the voices of karma mala. It's how you know that you're nailed in karma mala. So anava upaya practices are the practices where we use the body, where we use the breath, which is the breath is very much the bridge between the subtle and the physical. Because the tantras say that when pure consciousness, when pure awareness is in the process of becoming dense, the first stage before physicalization is the stage where that infinitely subtle consciousness becomes prana shakti, the life force energy that is going to vitalize everything in the physical world. So the breath, the prana, the senses, the physical body are the tools we use in anava upaya to internalize awareness. So if we want to create inward-facing consciousness, generally speaking, we start with the breath, which, as we know, is the, you know, fail-safe, pan-traditional methodology for the yoga of inward-facing consciousness. Anava upaya practices also include asana, yoga asana, and mudra. It includes ritual, and tantra is very, very full of rituals. As those of you know who've read a lot of tantric texts, there are literally hundreds of practices that you do with your body that involve worship and movement and mudra. And one of the effects of ritual or of asana practice or of all these body practices is to, first of all, purify the body. That is to loosen the tensions and contractions in the body, which also automatically loosens the tensions and contractions in the mind, since, as we now know, the mind and the body are completely intertwined. And by making ritual offerings, or in modern traditions, we often, one of the main anava upaya practices that many people do is seva. The many forms of seva, making our actions offerings. Anava upaya practices also include meditation on the breath in the central channel, meditations on the chakras, the visualizations for activating chakras, for activating kundalini in the muladhara. These are all anava upaya practices where you as an individual are doing something in order to purify your consciousness and help your mind turn within. The classic Anava Upaya practice, which I think almost everyone on this call has practiced at one time or another, is to focus on the space between the in-breath and the out-breath. And you know how to do it. You focus on the flow of the breath, and you try to hear the sound of the mantra Hamsa as the sound of the breath. So you would inhale with hum, exhale with sa, and after a while your focus becomes so specific and particular that you begin to notice the space where the inhalation merges into the inner body before the exhalation arises, and to notice where the exhalation merges into the air outside before the inhalation arises. And in this practice, your focus is first on the breath and the sound of the mantra, and then on the space between the breaths. And for those of you who've practiced this and who have had it cook inside you, you know that at a certain point, you will find yourself more and more focused on the space between the breaths, and you might even find yourself actually falling into the space between the breaths. So that pause actually becomes a doorway into Chaitanya. And this is one of the ways in which an Anava Upaya practice can lead you into merging with your own consciousness. So I want to do an Anava Upaya practice right now, a slightly different one. And you can find a posture. This is going to be a kind of a classic Anava Upaya visualization, and it's based on some of the very popular tantric visualization breath, rising energy visualizations. So because this is Valentine's Day, we're focusing in the heart today. So bring your attention with the inhalation into the heart center behind the breastbone. I'll just give you a minute to internalize your awareness with the breath. Imagine that in the very center of the heart is an altar, just a simple altar, and that in the middle of the altar is a thumb-sized flame. And as the inhalation comes in, feel that it touches the flame and that the exhalation makes the flame glow. So play with this for a moment or two. Now begin to offer the mantra Om into the flame with the inhalation. Now after the next inhalation, hold the breath, pause the breath, and listen to the instructions first before you do it. After the inhalation, next inhalation, we're going to pause the breath. And then in that pause, imagine the flame rising up from the heart, up through the throat, to the third eye, the center in the very middle of the head above the soft palate. So see if you can find that center before we do the whole practice. See if you can find that place above the soft palate in the very center of the head. So now inhaling into the heart with the thought Om, become aware of the flame, hold your breath, feel that in that pause, the flame and the mantra Om rise up through the throat, through the region of the jaw, up into the center of the head where it kindles a flame there. And you can exhale, feeling that the flame radiates through your head. Now inhale into the heart. Find the flame in the heart. Pause, hold the breath, and let the flame and the mantra Om ascend into the center of the head. And then exhale, letting the light of the flame radiate through the head. Take a couple of easeful breaths. And now at your own pace, begin to perform this practice, inhaling into the heart with Om, sensing the flame in the heart, holding the breath, and allowing the flame to rise up through the throat to the center of the head, to kindle the flame in the head, then exhaling, letting that flame radiate. I'll just perform this Anava Upaya meditation 5 times at your own pace. If you need to, take a couple of breaths between practices, that's totally fine. Perhaps some of you have noticed that as you keep doing this practice, which, you know, is kind of hard work at the beginning, especially the holding your breath part, but as you start doing the practice, it actually begins to happen on its own. The reason being that there is a groove in consciousness that connects the heart center with the third eye center. And this practice starts to activate something that's already there. And though the practice starts out feeling kind of technical and specific, and maybe you worry whether you're doing it right, eventually, as you keep practicing it, your attention becomes more and more naturally indrawn. And after a while, you become almost unconscious of what's going on outside, and you're in the state of indrawn meditation. Do this enough, you become adept at it. Do it enough, and it becomes natural to actually turn your awareness back to the heart and feel that flow of breath or feel that flame in the heart in situations in which you're not in seated meditation. So why do these practices help us experience freedom from karma mala? Partly because they disentangle our identification from the physical body by using the different components of the physical body, that is, the inner body and the breath, that is, the subtler components of the physical body, to shift our sense of what it is to be embodied, such that we are learning to identify with the subtle body rather than the physical, and with the flow of consciousness, rather than our consciousness being stuck or parked in a particular place. And the more you can be inwardly centered through a practice like this, the more you discover that as you move through the world, as you act through the world, as you interact with other people, it's coming from a different place. It's coming from a more spontaneous, more fluid, more flowing place. This focus in the heart, which is something that I've been practicing for a long time, and if you've been studying with me for a while, you know that I teach it a lot. My experience with maintaining heart focus, inner body focus, is that everything about the way I interact changed as I began to maintain an inner body focus, from the authenticity with which I spoke to people to my athletic abilities. The whole way that my body acted and spoke shifted through this Anavamala practice of focusing in the heart. So Anavamala practice is usually considered a beginner practice because it starts from where we are, starts from, you know, identification with the body and duality. But in my experience, it is not a beginner's practice, although, you know, actually Anavamala practices can be kind of technical and difficult. But what it is that for most of us, an Anavamala practice is our first line of self-transformation when we are outwardly focused in duality and we want to refocus ourselves inwardly, whether at the beginning of meditation or just in the course of a day. You know, when you're having a difficult day and you turn your attention into the heart and you begin saying your mantra, you're doing an Anavamala practice. This has innumerable effects, as we've been saying. And it's also it's very, very powerful to do Hatha Yoga, which, of course, is classic Anavamala because it uses the body. But it's very powerful to do Hatha Yoga with attention to the breath and attention to the heart or attention to the belly center, rather than doing Hatha Yoga like a, you know, ordinary athletic practice or something that you would do at the gym. Most of us who do a lot of Hatha Yoga have actually upon occasion done yoga in front of the TV, right? Or in my case, while reading a book, I can actually do many, many asanas while reading a book. Standing poses are hard, but down dog is really easy to do while I'm reading. So this is not really an Anavamala practice. It's, you know, it's athletics. It's exercise calling itself yoga. It becomes an Anavamala practice when you're really focused on the breath, on the movement of energy in the asana, and on your inner body. And, of course, since so many of you are powerful Hatha yogis and Hatha yoga teachers, you know this already. Anavamala practice, little by little, gives us the experience of moving from the identification with the physical body, which keeps us stuck in being a body, to a much more subtle and expanded experience of starting to know ourselves as energetic beings. And as we start to recognize ourselves as energetic beings through Anavamala practice and interiorizing our awareness in this way, it not only begins to loosen our karma mala, it also starts to morph into the next level of practice, the Shaktaupaya practice. Shaktaupaya, as again most of you know, is often translated as the empowered means, or I would call it the shaktified means, because it makes use of shakti. Essentially, Shaktaupaya practices are practices that work directly with shakti, and I'll explain what that means in Chema Raja's terms. Anavamala practices, generally speaking, work with the kriya shakti, the power of action, whereas Shaktaupaya practices work with the jnana shakti, the power of knowledge, the power of thought. And I find it very interesting that the tantras equate shakti with thought, and they really, really do. You know, Shaktaupaya is the antidote to Mayamala, which is essentially the contraction that comes about through the psychic instruments, through the mental processes, such as thinking, attention, ego identification, etc. Shaktaupaya not only works with the mind, it works with language. mantra, and especially with the energetic felt sense inside language. And this, to me, is extremely important. When we look at thoughts and mantras and the currents of mood in our, inside us as Shakti, which, of course, is what the Pratyabhijna Hridayam is all about, that's when we start to free ourselves from identifying with our mental creations about ourselves and start to be able to actually work, practice freely with what's going on in their mind. Shakta Upaya practices, generally speaking, are all about finding the energy in thought and encouraging the citta to merge thoughts into awareness such that the citta can merge into citti. In Shakta Upaya, we become very granularly attentive to the energy being generated by a thought, by the thoughts we're holding. And then we learn how to change or dissolve these energies, sometimes by changing our thoughts, sometimes by changing the way we're holding the thoughts. So, for example, in the Vijnana Bhairava, and actually we've been doing this practice off and on throughout the class, there's a dharana, and a concentration practice, which is considered Shakta Upaya, in which you say to yourself, wherever the mind goes, inside or outside, everywhere is the state of Shiva. It's one of my favorite practices, because it's so forgiving about the fact that most of the time most of us are thinking. I certainly am. And if you use this thought, wherever my mind goes, whatever thoughts are coming up, everywhere is Shiva. When Shiva is everywhere, this is the second line of the dharana, where can my mind go to escape him or her, as the case may be? So this is the Shakta Upaya practice. And if you followed me and did that, you probably noticed that something happened to your inner world as a result of that thought. So a lot of Shakta Upaya practice is skillfully using high thoughts, enlightened thoughts, to replace our contracted thoughts. In contemporary practice, though, we have a new, what I would say, it's probably not new because nothing is new, but there tends to be a lot of emphasis in contemporary practice of noticing the stories that we're telling ourselves and then questioning them or dropping them or replacing a limiting or negative story with a liberating one. And the way I have learned to do this, and I know that many of you have as well, is to notice the energy that certain thoughts create. And if you really start to look into your thoughts, to inquire as to the power of thoughts, you start to recognize very clearly that certain thoughts bring you down and other thoughts uplift you. And given the fact that we are all agreed that it's important to hold space for negative thoughts, in other words, not to try to push away negative thoughts, but to learn how to hold negative thoughts in spaciousness, which is, by the way, also a Shakta Upaya practice. Nonetheless, when you start to recognize that you have that certain negative thoughts are coming up again and again, in other words, that you have a habit of holding certain negative thoughts, at a certain point, it becomes very skillful to figure out how to replace them and to get quite disciplined about replacing them. So when you realize that certain thoughts immediately start to create painful emotions and that certain thoughts tend to make you feel more positive, you discover that one of the ways you can shift energy is by shifting thoughts. This is, of course, as we all know, an increasingly common practice, especially in the mindfulness world, especially in the cognitive therapy world. We are really making great strides in using Shakta Upaya practices for thought shifting. Abhinavagupta, who was Kshemaraja's guru, wrote, "One who wishes to ascend beyond Maya should first purify his thoughts." So the tantric sages were all about thought substitution. They really believed in that process. And what Abhinavagupta meant by purifying thoughts was actually quite specific. He tells us again and again to keep our thinking centered on thoughts that connect us to non-duality. These are called, or Abhinavagupta calls them, shuddha vikalpas. Vikalpa means thought, and shuddha means pure. So a pure thought, a shuddha vikalpa, is a thought that has no mundane associations, that only relates to the highest. Mantras, of course, are a great example of shuddha vikalpa, and it's one reason why they're so important in Tantra. So the great mantras, the great deity mantras especially, are considered to be the sonic forms of higher powers. And in my experience, and again, many, many people in this satsang who use mantra powerfully and creatively and have discovered that when you work with the mantra and really let it insinuate itself into your chitta, that the mantra will dye your chitta, D-Y-E, it'll color your chitta in the energy of the higher tattvas, which is one reason why mantra practice tends to be blissful, tends to create ease and rest. That is, if you're a person who responds to mantra, not everybody is. But there is a particular secret to Shakta Upaya as regards mantra, which really permeates the whole of the Pratibhigna Hridayam, which is the tantric approach to mantra. When we practice with a mantra or with a non-dual thought, like everywhere my mind goes is Shiva, or my thoughts are made of chitti, or I am awareness taking on a human body, which is a good thing to hold on to, or all this is inside me, the secret is to identify with it. So again, identification, how you use your ego is absolutely crucial to the tantric approach to practice. You know, in Sanskrit, the word for ego is ahamkara. And ahamkara means I-former, the maker of I-ness. So the bound ego, the limited ego, is the ego that says, I am this personality. You know, I'm the child of my parents. I grew up in New Jersey. I'm, X number of years old. I look like this. That's the limited ego. Then there's the ego of Shakta Upaya, which identifies itself with mantra, which identifies itself with higher thoughts. I am Shiva is one of the powerful ones. I am Shakti. My thoughts are Shakti. So Shakta Upaya occupies the middle ground between absolute duality, I am here and you're there, and absolute unity. So in Douglas Brooks' words, which is quite a nice way of thinking about this, Douglas says, duality says, I am different than you. Non-duality says, I am the same as you. The Shakta Upaya, or dual non-dual viewpoint, in Sanskrit, beda beda, dual and yet non-dual, says, I am somewhat like you and somewhat different than you. In other words, part of your attention, part of your awareness identifies with duality, but another part of your awareness is more and more skillfully beginning to identify with non-duality. As Abhinavagupta says, Shakta Upaya is about replacing false knowledge with true knowledge, meaning replacing those stories that you keep telling yourself that are based on your conditioning and old trauma and understandings about yourself that you maybe developed at age 1.5 because there were things in your environment you couldn't handle, but which are now so deeply embedded that you don't even know that you have them. False knowledge is not just, wrong ideas like the earth is flat. False knowledge is everything that conditions you to believe in limitation. And true knowledge is everything that conditions you towards non-duality. And this practice of identifying yourself with your highest self, with chitti, with the heart of God, with all-pervading consciousness, with beauty, these practices are called bhavanas or creative contemplations, where you actually use your mind to create a reality that will expand you and take you higher. This word bhavana, which is, it's in Tantra, it signifies a particular practice, a contemplation practice of self-transformation through imagination. It's the root of it is the word bhava, B-H-A-V-A, which means essentially attitude. And in Tantra, the understanding about bhava is that your attitude towards yourself and your attitude towards the world should always be an attitude that takes you to your growth edge. In other words, your bhava should be one that inspires you to grow beyond your limitations. Years ago, I was I was with my guru, and he was giving an interview to an English reporter who was having a lot of trouble getting his tape recorder to work. And finally, the reporter said, "I'm sorry I'm not getting this right, but what can I do? I'm only human." And my guru said, "That's your only mistake, thinking that you're human. You're not human. You're Shiva." And the reporter's mouth fell open. He was pointing out an extreme example of a limiting bhava, which is, I'm only human. I would say a more expansive bhava would be to say, okay, I am human, but I'm also divine. Another, other Shakta Upaya practices are the actual self-inquiry, like that we were talking about earlier. And they're Shakta Upaya because they use words. When you ask, who am I really, or who is the knower, and after asking the question, an awareness arises, that is, an awareness of your own essence, of your own chetana, once wordless awareness of your true nature arises, you are in the third upaya, which is Shambhava upaya, which has no words, which is pure experience of spirit. We'll get into that in a moment. But I just want to tell you a story that is, I think, very beautifully explains the power of Shakta Upaya practice. It's a Tibetan story, and the story is of a seeker who was assigned by his guru to do 100,000 repetitions of a very complicated mantra, and he was supposed to have it done by a certain date when he was supposed to go see his guru and report. Now, in Tibet, in certain sects, this practice of doing 100,000 repetitions of a mantra is considered it's a required preliminary practice before you get the higher teachings. And many people in that tradition, as in other spiritual traditions, how shall I say, are, not that diligent. So this guy was pretty busy, and he didn't actually start doing his mantra practice until 3 days before he was supposed to go back to his guru and report. So by the time, the day before he was supposed to show up, he had done maybe 200 repetitions of the mantra, and then he had this brilliant idea. He went up to a nearby mountain. It was Tibet, after all. And as he was sitting on the mountain, he began to repeat the mantra, but with the bhavana that every being in the universe was repeating the mantra with him. And he sat for an hour having this feeling that millions of beings all over the planet were repeating his mantra. And you might try it. It's actually fabulous practice. And then he went back to his guru. Let us just try this for a moment. We can practice with Om. So just have the feeling as you inhale that you inhale into the heart with the sound of Om, feeling the energy in it as it flows with the breath and impacts the heart with a soft kind of caress. And then feel, recognize that everybody in the universe is breathing in Om into the heart. Wherever they are, certainly everyone in this vortex of Sangam, we're all doing it together. But with your bhavana, you bring every being in the world into our practice. Pretty nice, huh? So the seeker goes back to his guru, and the guru says, so tell me about your practice. And the seeker says, well, I have to confess, I put off doing the mantra practice for a really long time. And then this afternoon, I went up on nearby mountain and I said it, thinking that everyone in the world was saying it with me. And the guru bowed down in front of him and he said, oh, you see what happened? Your enlightened understanding multiplied the power of the mantra such that it was as if you had repeated it 30 million times. So by repeating this mantra for an hour with the thought that all beings were repeating it, you've acquired the merit of millions and millions of repetitions. So this is Shakta Upaya practice. It has really a lot of power. It's subtle. It kindles the creative power within the mind. As we'll see in one of the subsequent sutras, it kindles the shakti, the strength, the bala in the mind. Word bala in Sanskrit means strength. It means the unique, specific power that the mind has, that awareness has, to transform things. Shakta Upaya practice, in my experience, is perhaps the most direct way I know to transform the mind, you know, the mind of a person who no longer totally identifies with the body, although, you know, when you trip and fall, stub your toe, it's very hard not to identify with the body, but most of the time, most of us are more identified with the personality, more identified with our thoughts because we tend to believe our thoughts. So Shakta Upaya practice will very directly transform your mind and thus your sense of self. Abhinavagupta writes, when a thought is purified, it engenders another thought which is pure in itself. This thought produces another thought similar to itself, and then this latter thought produces another. So it's kind of like in neurophysiology, they've come to the realization that neurons form clusters, and that the clusters are essentially composed of similar or linked thought patterns or emotional patterns because thoughts are magnetic. So, and this means that obviously when we think in a certain way for a period of time, that thought habit attracts other similar thoughts and they form neural connections. The phrase is neurons that fire together, wire together. So if you keep thinking, I don't know how to do this, I don't know how to do this, I don't know how to do this, that thought is going to have a very, very big impact because it's going to bring up all the other neuronal clusters of similar thoughts. And in the same way, of course, when you keep thinking, God's heart is my heart, these form neuronal clusters that attract other thought forms. And that's what it means to purify the mind. It means to fill it with shuddha-vidya, with shuddha-vikalpa, with beautiful, pure thoughts, pure knowledge, pure awareness. And again, I want to say that this is not about trying to chase negativities out of the mind, which, as we all know, doesn't work. It's about really being very serious, playfully serious, but serious, about curating your thoughts. Somebody used that wonderful phrase in a thread on the listserv today. We become the curators of our own minds. That's what Shakta Upaya is about. It's about curating your mind. And, you know, when you're training your mind with Shakta Upaya, you become very creative about how you use thought to enlighten yourself. According to Abhinavagupta, again, who really dealt with this issue quite a lot. He says, if you hold a thought like I am present everywhere or I am pure light, by holding onto this thought with great attention, that pure thought will eventually lead you to the thought-free state. So, in other words, holding on to a beautiful, enlightened thought eventually frees the mind of all thoughts, allows us to move more and more into deep contact with the love beauty of what we really are. And then we start to experience essential emotions like love and gratitude and tenderness that just begin to happen spontaneously. And these feelings begin to move more and more into the foreground. And then what happens is that our consciousness, the underlying consciousness, the chetana, begins to, as we said earlier, come to the foreground and expand. And at that point, we find ourselves practicing Shambhavupaya, which Shambhavupaya means that the translation is, this is a means of spirit, it's a means of Shiva. But what Shiva means in this case is pure spirit. So Shambhavupaya is very subtle. It's not something that you do. It's more a matter of using your subtle will to hold on to an expanded state when it arises. And it's even a little gross to say hold on, because, as you know, we can't really hold on to anything, since this is a universe of endlessly changing chitti, shakti. Everything moves, everything changes. But if your intention is to stay poised in the infinite, poised in the absolute, poised in awareness, then gradually you keep bringing yourself back to awareness, not so much by thinking or by breathing, but simply by intention. So suppose you're practicing being aware of awareness, using the mind to remind yourself, I am awareness. And then suppose there's a shift where you become aware that your body and mind are actually being experienced by something much subtler, that is, by awareness itself. In other words, the shift happens and the thing you're practicing becomes your real experience. Normally, this is fleeting. You know, obviously, our practice makes it less fleeting. But if, without grasping or anxiety, you can keep yourself present to the sense of awareness constantly rising through the thoughts and perceptions, just by having this subtle intention to remain awake. So Shambhavupaya, by the way, it's not an intellectual recognition. If it's an intellectual recognition, if it uses thoughts, it's Shakta Upaya. It happens when we're genuinely inside the experience. In other words, when we've realized that we are awareness, when we are really identified fully with awareness. And the more you can relax into being awareness or being, or just tuning into that part of you which is just pure isness, beingness, then the more that awareness begins to expand back into the great awareness, into genuine non-duality. And there's a fourth upaya, which is called anupaya, meaning the means of no means, the method of no method, which is the instantaneous, spontaneous recognition of the truth. That's the experience where the teacher says, you are consciousness, and you immediately find yourself plunged into the experience of yourself as pure awareness. So let's just take a moment and do this practice that I was talking about in the beginning, this practice of fivefold act consciousness. So close your eyes and just be with the breath for a moment. And now create an intention for yourself, a bhavana for yourself. When I open my eyes, I am going to recognize that the entire field of my visual experience is pouring forth from within my heart. So make that thought very strong, and then open your eyes with the feeling that what you see has poured forth from your heart. And now close your eyes and feel that you draw this creation, the room, wherever it is you're sitting or standing, you draw it into your awareness. You dissolve what you just witnessed into awareness. Now once again, have the thought, when I open my eyes, this room in all its detail will pour forth from within the heart. Not different than me, emanating from me, held inside my awareness. I manifest this room. Just notice how the room feels to you when you're having that bhavana. And then close your eyes. Have the thought, I withdraw this creation, this manifestation, into myself, and let your attention flow back into recognition of the awareness that is you. Let your awareness expand backwards. Now, as you open your eyes again, feel that the room that has been dissolved in your awareness now manifests again. Close your eyes. Draw it back. Now, obviously, for most of us, some part of us, consciousness, is concealing the non-duality of what we see with our eyes open and is retaining some trace of memory of it as the memory of the room conceals itself. When we close our eyes, now see in this moment, if you can, with one great gesture, just have the bhavana, I dissolve the memory of this room into the field of my own consciousness, the field of my citta. And just let yourself experience your own citta, your own mind stuff. The energetic field that is your inner consciousness, expanded or contracted, it's still made of chitti. So, inward-facing awareness, three methods. Using mind and breath to internalize attention into the inner body. 2, using the energy in mantras or enlightened thoughts to purify the mind, refine the citta so that it becomes subtler and subtler and ultimately merges into chetana. And finally, cultivating our capacity to stay poised in that state of citta, of pure unconditioned awareness, and allow it to unfold backwards up the tattvas and recognize itself as pure Shiva Shakti. And if you really examine the practices that different traditions use to make consciousness inward facing, which is what all spiritual practice is about, you realize that every one of them fits into the upayas. Getting to know your own state, and this is very important. This is one of those things, you know, sometimes a teacher will say, if you just learn one thing from me, learn this. This is one of those one things. If you get to know how you personally practice with different upayas, then you start to realize what medicine is required in this moment. And, you know, I often say that I usually start meditation with a concentrative practice, with an anava upaya practice, you know, posture, breath, mantra, attention, you know, a very, very deliberate practice. At a certain point, there's a natural segue into a shakta upaya practice where there's less a sense of inside and outside and you're more inside your own awareness. And then when meditation really is opening up, pure awareness reveals itself. And for most of us, that kind of process where you start with, you know, you start in duality and you start with an anava upaya practice and then you allow shakta upaya and shambhava upaya to arise naturally, which they will, then your practice is very, very targeted, especially when you understand that your goal is inward-facing consciousness. You're always wanting consciousness to turn in, to turn backward, to look back on itself. And as we practice this, as we learn how to allow awareness to swallow up our dichotomizing thought constructs, sometimes very strongly, sometimes just a little bit, what happens is that our citta, our mind, starts to refine itself and to become stronger and stronger, and acquiring of what is sometimes called personal power. I think that comes from a shamanic description of inner practice. We acquire personal power, which is basically power of the citta, power of our mind field. That power is acquired by the citta turning again and again and again to face into itself such that we recognize pure consciousness, pure awareness as our deepest self. The more we do that, the more we acquire what Sutra 15 calls bala. And what Sutra 15 says is bala labhe vishvam atmasat karoti. Bala labhe vishvam atmasat karoti. Attaining one's innate power, one absorbs everything into oneself. In other words, as you refine your consciousness through practice, through inner absorption, through self-recognition, the intrinsic power within consciousness begins to become stronger and stronger and stronger, so that your mind actually becomes capable of dissolving thoughts and emotions into awareness. This becomes something that you know how to do and you can do with ease. So station your attention once again in the heart. Close your eyes and pull your attention into the heart. And once again, before you open your eyes, have the bhavana, this world is flowing out of my heart, appearing as a world. And close your eyes and feel that it flows back into you. And notice that there probably is an after image of the room. Now see if you can dissolve the after image. See if you can let the subtle trace memory of the room dissolve back into the stuff of your citta, so that you're only conscious of the field of your own awareness, the field of your own consciousness, your own mind stuff. And just see if you can, as I'm talking, keep opening and closing your eyes. Opening your eyes with the sense that you create the room. Closing your eyes with the feeling that the room is withdrawn. And see if you can notice how, as you keep practicing with this bhavana, the feeling of inside-outside begins to become not so strong, the sense of boundary between me and here and the room out there becomes much more fluid. You might even feel for a moment or two that your inner self-sense, your inner awareness, actually does expand from the heart and hold or permeate the scene you see with your eyes open. So by practicing absorbing your exterior experience into your self-sense and then feeling that you manifest it from inside, you start to begin to recognize the power of your own awareness. And what I would like to say from my own experience, and I think you all know this, or many of you do from practice, is that when you deliberately connect your interior experience, let's say your heart, with what you're seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, that normally appears to be outside your body, you are more and more in touch, not just with your own feeling of being centered, but also with your own power, the intrinsic power that belongs to awareness. It's like indrawn attention cultivates a kind of subtle muscle, which is, of course, a bad word, but it pretty much explains what I mean. It's like the muscles of attention begin to be strong enough for attention to pay attention to attention. And the more power your awareness acquires, the more the intrinsic strength of awareness is cultivated by your attention to it, the more power it has to expand and show you what you are. And honestly, there's nothing else, there's nobody else that can show you what you are. Only your awareness can show you. Kshemaraja goes on to say in the next sutra, Sutra 16, this experience brings about the discovery of Chidananda, the bliss of pure awareness, which is the essential experience of being immersed in your own consciousness, your own awareness, which has the nature of bliss, of joy. Kshema says that it's possible to become so connected to our own awareness that we continue experiencing it even when we're functioning in the world. And we'll talk more about that next week. That is the experience that the tantras call jiva mukti, or liberation in this life. It's the ability to be fully aware of your own awareness with all of its shimmering power and joy, even while you're walking through the world. So the bliss of consciousness, Chidananda, the taste of your inner self, flows out through your mind and senses and literally permeates your entire experience as awareness shows you again and again that the world which seems to be outside is actually inside, dyed with the flavor of pure love. So as we bring this satsang to a close, please close your eyes. Allow the breath to bring your attention into the heart. Say to yourself these enlightened words, which actually come from a poem by a Shaiva devotee. Shiva and Shakti are dancing in my heart, embracing in my heart. When I open my eyes, I see their dance embodied in the so-called world. Immersed as I am in the flavor of their embrace, I see that everything is the expansion of Shakti and Shiva. I have no idea where this word samsara comes from, because everything is the bliss of my own self. Have a beautiful evening, a beautiful day. Thank you so much. Big, big love to everyone. Namaste. Happy Valentine's Day.